I'm Danny Alexander, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The technology of the future is here. Today, we bring you conversations from this year that made us realize just how quickly our world is changing. We Americans love our automobiles, so we start with 3D printed cars, created by students in a project-based mentorship program right here in Kansas City. Then we'll figure out if a plan from Uber to get automated cars off the ground in 10 years is feasible or foolhardy. We'll wrap up with two conversations based around this year's Gigabit City Summit, where civic leaders found out how they can access and use data to improve cities across the country. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Danny Alexander, in for Steve Kraske. This week, we're highlighting great conversations from 2016. Today's theme, The Future is Now. We'll start with one of America's most influential innovations, the automobile. In March, KC students from the project-based learning program called MindDrive unveiled an experimental 3D-printed vehicle at Kansas City's International Auto Show. Here's Steve Kraske with members of MindDrive.
What's so cool about this car, besides the fact that it was printed? It was done so in, get this, 6 hours, and it looks like a Formula race car, 12 feet in length. Oh, it'll be electric. No, seriously, it's an electric car. Joining us to talk about this, Steve Reese. He's a MindDrive's co-founder. Steve, nice to have you again. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Lizette is also here. She worked on this project along with Luis. Lizette, good morning. Luis, good to have you.
Thanks.
Again, they're both MindDrive students here. Well, Steve Reese, you've been on our program before. Tell us about MindDrive. Remind us what that's all about.
MindDrive is a program that involves students, high school students from 15 different high schools. And it's experiential, hands-on, project-based, and it's taught by mentors.
They're doing stuff, real stuff.
They're doing real things, and they're working with real people from the business world. And we've got, in this particular class that we're working on this project, we have 25 students and we have 23 mentors. And,
wow. So it's one-on-one learning.
Almost one-on-one.
Yeah. Well, you and your students totally redid a Karmann Ghia and made it an electric car. How's it running these days?
Actually, we've done five.
Five.
And the car you're talking about, we still have it at the shop. It's for sale. but it runs great. And we've actually done five Karmann Ghias.
Now, I should clarify, when you print these things, you're not printing the engine and all that. You're printing the body we're talking about.
Okay, the car you're talking about is the Formula car, and it's just the structural part of the car. And
okay.
Again, it's 12 feet long, and the rules are the car can't be over 12 feet long or 4 feet wide, and it's powered by two 12-volt batteries in series to give you 24 volts. And the competition is to see how far the car can go in 1 hour.
Wow. Explain 3D printing to us, because, again, for a lot of people, they're struggling with the whole concept here, Steve, and you know that.
Well, 3D printing is one of those things that starts out small, and people have seen small things that have been printed.
I'm not sure I really have yet, but I know it's coming.
And people have talked about how it can be expanded, and you can build houses, you can build cars, and it's been a lot of talk, but it's actually happened. And we bumped into a company in Phoenix that actually built a chassis for a car on a printer that's in a room that's 15, that the printer itself is like 15 feet by 30 feet long. And so we saw this and we thought, what better thing for our students? You know, they're trying to learn new technology. And so I called them, and long story short, they hooked us up with being able to do this for us. So we provided them with a drawing, and then they actually printed it out. And it's the capability of the machine.
You say they printed it out like it was a piece of paper with some black ink on it. How does a car come out of a printer?
Okay, the printer you think of normally is like a copier.
Yeah, that's my world. Don't complicate my world, but you're about to complicate my world. Yeah.
Okay, so imagine you print that picture on a piece of paper, but then imagine doing 1,000 pieces of paper on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, then you can start to do the different shapes as you get higher in the mass. And in essence, you're 3D printing. So instead of 2D printing like you do in a copier, you're doing a 3D print, which is layers of information.
And this printer that you're working with worked really fast.
Yeah,
how long did it take to get the body of this car out?
Actually, it was 6 hours. And
6 hours.
6 hours. And actually, it could have printed in less than an hour had they not had to wait between layers for 30 minutes. It's just the sequence of how they do it. It can do 8 pounds of material in 1 hour.
And so what is the material the car is made of? What's the product here?
It's actually made of ABS plastic that's 20% carbon fiber. So it's
Is that most cars are made these days?
No. Most cars are, you'll see cars today are starting to be, you've heard of the Ford truck that's made with an aluminum, all aluminum. You're starting to hear people do carbon fiber components like hoods and things like that. This is carbon fiber, which is a very strong material and a lightweight material.
How much does it weigh?
The chassis came to us weighing 100 pounds, but we're going to be doing some things to lighten it. When it's done, it'll weigh about 55 pounds.
Well, Lisette, you have this car. What comes next? I mean, how do you turn it into a running vehicle with an engine in it and stuff?
So we're doing the electric cars right now, and we started with two body. And what we do is we start incorporating, like, the motor. And, you know, we do the designs ourselves. So we have the mentors who help us a lot in the design of the body. And, you know, so we can have the least amount of friction and things, so we have more efficiency. And we go incorporating the motors and the wires. And although the mentors do help a lot, it is a lot of the students that do the work. So I got to do a lot of things. This is my second year, so last year I got to learn a lot of new things building the electric cars.
Luis, is this as amazing to you as it is to me? Because I'm just bowled away by this.
Yes, it is. Actually, I work with the welding area on the cars.
Yeah.
Like putting the tubing together and like starting the car from the bottom.
Yeah.
That's the fun part.
Did you watch the thing being printed or did you just see the finished product?
We did see the finished product because we weren't able to go to the place.
Ah.
It was too far, but actually we saw some picture of Steve there and we see some pictures with the machine and everything.
Yeah.
We think it is cool.
I mean, this is like the future is changing right before our eyes. Am I right?
Yeah.
Am I seeing that right?
Yeah. I mean, if I had, you know, looked back from a couple years from where I was, I would have never thought that I'd be working on electric cars. I mean, it's something that's been evolving. I think we've, you know, been evolving to get to this point. I mean, with all the, like, fossil fuels that we've been using, I think electric would be the next step. And, you know, we're kind of hitting it on the head right now.
Hey, how did you get involved, Luis, with MindDrive? What was the attraction for you?
Well, it was two and a half years ago where my ESL teacher told me about MindDrive. She told me to, and I told her that I like to work with cars, and she told me about MindDrive, that they were working on the Carmen Ghia car.
Mm-hmm.
And it was electric, and like I started filling up the applications and attending every Saturday. I liked it. We were like working on the car, cleaning in it. Steve was working on the electric area, and I found out about the Wednesday class, that is the welding class, and I used to work welding a few years ago. So,
what did you like about the whole setup?
The whole setup. Mentors mm-hmm. helped me a lot. They give advice every time they see me in the shop.
So you're learning a lot, it sounds like.
Yeah, I do. I used to work with cars, but they are like gas cars, you know. But
all that old-fashioned stuff. Yeah.
So I think we're learning the future.
Yeah. Lisette, how about you? What was the attraction?
Well, you know, Steve came to my school, and we hadn't had this program at my school yet. And so I'm in the engineering academy in my school, and they put us into different pathways. And being in the engineering academy as a girl, there's not that much, there's not many other girls. So I found out about...
Which might be a good thing for you, by the way.
Yeah. So when I heard about MindDrive, I heard, you know, the automotive program, not a lot of girls do that either. You know, a lot of girls stick to other type of pathways. And I thought it would be a lot of fun. Some of my friends joined too, and I've been there this is my second year, so it's been a ride.
Steve, now there's a competition involved here. You've alluded to it here. Tell us about that.
It's called Electrothon America, which has been around for over a decade, and it's for high school students, high school sponsored cars. And the kids build these cars, come together, and they compete to see who can go the farthest distance in 1 hour.
How do you wind up working to increase the car's efficiency, Lisette? How's that going to happen?
Well, there's five factors to, you know, enhance the efficiency. So it's the weight of the car itself, the friction, like the rolling resistance and stuff like that. You have...
Look how well you've taught her, Steve. She's just ticking these things right off the top of her head. That's very impressive. Yeah.
And then there's, like I said, the weight, but it like the weight incorporates the person driving, also the airflow of the car, so air resistance,
that's
the frontal
four.
Area.
That's four. You got one more for me?
The frontal area of the car.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, I forgot the last one, Steve.
Actually, there's just friction of like the bearings and motor
yeah.
and
yeah.
things like that.
So like yeah. the interior friction of the car.
Now, this is an experimental car, Luis. Are there safety features built into this thing?
Yes, we do have a roving bar.
Roll bar.
Roll bar, and mm-hmm. we have the... How do
safety harnesses, a five-point safety harness, racing mm-hmm. harness, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have helmets, and so they'll be just, in essence, just like a real race car.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine a time that the three of you in 3D-printed cars will go into wide production, just based on what you've learned so far? Is this the future? Is this what's going to be the way it's done in 5, 10 years?
So we've been... Like I've said before, we've been evolving a lot. Our technology's been a lot faster. I was born in a time where the internet started, and it just
I was around even before the internet, if you
right.
can believe that.
So
yeah.
I mean, the way that everything's been evolving, it's just shooting straight forward. So I mean, we have cars now that they've been doing a lot of different things for safety regulations. So I think 3D printed cars might just be the next big thing.
Wow. Steve, what lessons can people in Kansas City and beyond learn from what you guys are doing here?
You know, the most obvious lesson is the involvement of the people in the community and their students and their children.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes a village to raise a child. It's
the importance of mentoring you're talking about.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And the mentors, they think, I'm not really an educator, but they're just wonderful. And they not only work with the academics of the student, but they also are there as another voice in their life. And they show up and they're driving a Mazda and they've got a successful family and they go on vacations. And the kids see these things and it influences their vision of what their future will be.
That's just such a cool thing. What a great idea. What a great program. That's Steve Reese. He's MindDrive's co-founder. He was joined today by two of his students, Lisette and Luis. Thanks very much, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us.
From time to time, we look toward the future to see what technology may hold. One question we at UpToDate use to judge just how far we've come, when will we get flying cars? The answers have been imprecise and disappointing, until now. Sanjeev Singh co-founded Near Earth Autonomy. Joining Steve Kraske by Skype, Alex Davies is transportation editor for Wired magazine. In November, they gave Steve the hows and whens of a new plan from Uber.
Alex, you wrote about this just last month when Uber released a 99-page white paper revealing its plan. Give us the elevator pitch from that paper. What's Uber hoping to have, and when is it hoping to have it?
So Uber doesn't plan to actually build any kind of flying car. What the company is saying is that it's identified some trends in aviation technology, saying, hey, there are a bunch of companies working on electric planes that can take off and land vertically, so they don't need runways, they can land in cities. And we think that within 5 to 10 years, the battery technology and the aviation technology will be there, and that we can help get these things certified with the FAA.
Wow.
And then Uber says, well, if these things are going to be ready, then we've got tens of millions of users who like driving in our cars already and certainly would love to fly to work or fly to that party instead of having to drive through traffic. So they're saying that if they can get everybody together to actually make this technology happen, then they want to be the ones putting it into practice. Basically, they're saying, you guys work on the supply, we've got the demand.
Sanjeev, you worked on a flying car project for DARPA. That's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Department of Defense. How convinced are you that flying vehicles are possible?
Well, there's a couple of ways to think about this. One is a sort of a technical feasibility issue as to whether these mechanisms can be, used for flying short distances in the way that people are talking about now. Then there's a kind of question as to whether they can be autonomous, where they can fly sufficiently autonomously. And then the third thing is whether they can meet the standards we have for aviation. And I think those are three complex kinds of interleaving issues. And for something to be acceptable in the way that we could use it just like we use a taxi today, we'd have to make progress on all three of those things.
And given the way I introduced the show, Sanjeev, I said they might be available within a decade. Do you buy that?
Actually, I've given up trying to predict the future.
Ah, yeah, smart, you know, smart man.
Technology is one key element, obviously, right? It's what, if you don't have the technology, then you can't do it at all. But then after that, there's how we can use it in off-nominal cases, you know, which is what a lot of aviation practice is all about today, is all of the things that can go wrong that happen 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 times, and then our cultural acceptance of these kinds of things. So, for example, if these things are possible and the FAA says, yes, you can do this, but they're way too loud to be used inside cities, then, you know, that would have to, we'd have to reconsider that as to whether they'd be viable. You know, all the people around where one of these things would be taken off would be not be happy to have this really, really loud vehicle taken off right in front of their or right outside their offices or homes. And, you know, just imagine if a helicopter landed right outside your home every day, you might not be very happy about it if that was not something you were doing. So now the future vehicles are going to be quiet, but quieter. But that's to be seen as to whether we can get social acceptance, whether we can make these things reliable enough, in addition to making them be technically feasible.
Yeah. Alex, is this going to require, you know, licensed pilots for each flying car? Is that what we're talking about here?
Right now, Uber is saying that, yes, you will need pilots for each car, at least to begin with. Ultimately, they think this is a kind of system that could use autonomous technology to fly. They don't expect, though, to have pilots as well trained as the men and women who are flying 747 and 737s around the country. They're saying that because these systems would have to have much more sophisticated technology, more sophisticated autopilots just to move through urban airspace, that then you might be able to get pilots with less sophisticated training and thus making that barrier a little easier to clear. The problem there is that the FAA almost certainly won't love the idea of being like, sure, like just fly these things around cities and no, you don't have to have, you know, as capable pilots as, you know, the ones who are already flying today.
Sanjeev, this gets into your area now. Your company, Near Earth Autonomy, develops systems to make low-flying aircraft autonomous. Have you reached the point yet of a craft delivering humans without the aid of a pilot?
Well, you know, we have technology that makes all kinds of vehicles fly. We work on a large helicopter, think about news chopper scale, that can take off, it can fly, it can land in adverse environments, complex environments today. That's what we're working on right now. So the base technology is there, and we continue to improve it. Now, how it's applied to this kind of passenger transport is yet another question.
So you haven't gotten to that point yet?
Well, I mean, we're flying large helicopters autonomously, right? So we can do that today.
And when you say autonomously, you're saying unmanned. You're implying unmanned there, right?
To be technically correct, autonomous and unmanned are two slightly different issues.
Oh, okay.
You know, if you have a vehicle that has somebody in it, then it's manned, okay, when they may not be controlling it. It will have people in it, but autonomous means it's flying by itself. You've all heard about the self-driving cars that are intended. Uber is one of the companies developing this technology, and that will be manned. You know, there'll be people in it, and it will be autonomous. So the same idea exists there. So whether there are people there or not is a slightly different issue as to whether these things can fly themselves. And today, at various scales, from small to full-size helicopters, we can take off, we can fly some great distance, and we can land in fairly complex environments without having a helicopter pilot.
What are some of the most important functions that an autonomous vehicle has to be able to perform while in the air, Sanjeev?
So there's three things that the FAA wants, at least the way we understand it. So first, it has to be controllable all by itself. There's no radio link that can be dependent upon. So it has to be able to make its own decisions, and such that if it loses links, it can do fine, go from A to B. Number two is it has to be able to sense and avoid anything that might be in its way, and then, you know, just like a pilot would be, if it's another aircraft, if it's going right at some terrain for whatever reason, it has to be able to avoid it. If it's going to a tower or some power lines, it has to be able to avoid those kinds of things. Maybe those things were not on the map, and therefore it had a flight plan that put it in risk of collision. It should be able to avoid it. And the third thing that we understand is that the FAA wants is that if the vehicle were to lose GPS, then it should be able to fly safely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a kind of a basic. These are like basic kinds of things,
right,
that we work on. And then there's another very important area, which is what happens if some critical system goes out, an engine fails, a sensor fails, some other thing happens. So it has to land very quickly. How does it do that? There is no easy equivalent of pulling over when you are in the air. Okay.
I gather that. Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date this morning, and we're talking about flying cars in the future and what it might look like. Alex Davies is with us. He's with Wired. Sanjeev Singh is the CEO and co-founder of a group called Near Earth Autonomy. Alex, how does Uber plan to develop and build this fleet? I mean, it isn't basically a software and services company, so what's going to happen here?
So Uber says that it doesn't want any active role in developing the aviation technology or actually making these things fly. It says it wants to be a catalyst for getting all this stuff going.
Why not get involved with it? What's holding it back from actually engaging in the technology if it might mean such a huge boost to the bottom line of that company?
I think it's just such a major hardware investment that they're not willing to go there, especially since other people are working on it. Even though, you know, with the self-driving car project that Sanjeev mentioned, they are building those cars, and they say they're doing that because, well, no one else was doing it fast enough for their own pace. I guess here they're a little more willing to let other people develop the physical technology, and then they want to be the ones going to the FAA saying, hey, here are the kinds of certifications we want, and going to industry and saying, here are the kind of parameters we need planes to meet, and basically getting everybody to meet in the middle and then reaping the benefits of what they've together produced.
Mm-hmm. Sanjeev, you know, two major design features that will separate these vehicles from the small planes we know today are power source and takeoff. How will those be different in flying cars?
So I think the main thing that usually distinguishes these things is that they are vertical takeoff and landing. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Irrespective of which exact mechanism is used and how exactly the long duration flight is conducted, the simplest way to think about this is like a helicopter or a multi-rotor. So you imagine that everybody is using these small drones, we call them quad rotors or multi-rotors, and essentially these are ways to take off and come down directly. And what key about that is that if you can do this vertical takeoff and landing, then you can land at these helipads or vertiports, or there's a few other names for these kinds of places where you take off and land, and I think that is critical because then you don't need a runway, you don't need the kind of airport infrastructure that we use for little planes today. Then the second part that I think is different is that, you know, there's some key technology that's going to simplify the cost of these things, because clearly we have helicopters and we don't use them today. So there are some new ways of doing propulsion. There's a simple way. It's called distributed electric propulsion, which think of this as many small rotors rather than one large rotor. And what that happens is if they're electric, you can actually make them simpler, cheaper, easier to maintain, and possibly quieter than aircraft today. So I think this would be the two things that would distinguish the mechanism itself. Then there's a whole piece that makes them fly by themselves, which is yet another dimension.
Alex, we're going to have to develop, or at least Uber will, a whole network of these helicopter pads then, right?
That's where Uber says it's got an advantage, at least in a couple of cities. Basically, they're saying, you know, we don't need runways, we don't need airports, we need flat surfaces that can, you know, with outlets nearby. And mainly, if you look at like San Francisco and New York and LA, these are cities that have a lot of helipads on them, even if they're not that commonly used. And I think it's important to note that at least in the early years of this imagined project, that Uber doesn't want these helipads all over the place. Say, you know, you're going from San Francisco to Palo Alto, which is a terrible thing to drive every day. You might have two helipads in San Francisco and two in Palo Alto. And then once you land in downtown San Francisco or wherever, then you have your self-driving Uber or your regular Uber pick you up and take you the last few miles to your destination. It's more of a end-to-end thing. It's not quite door-to-door in the near term.
So these flying cars, Alex, you don't see them both driving on the highway and flying?
Well, Uber actually doesn't like using the term flying cars at all. They're not flying cars in the sense that they'll both fly and drive. They're flying cars more in that kind of Jetsons sense of the word, in that these are cars that you use to make relatively short trips. It's personal transport that happens to be through the air rather than on the ground.
Yeah. You know, a lot of things have to come together to make Uber's dream a reality. One of those is how to regulate these things. We've seen the difficulty the FAA has had with drones, Alex. How much of a stumbling block could regulating vertical takeoff and landing aircraft be to Uber's plans eventually here?
This is the stumbling block. Like Sanjeev noted, when I spoke to various aviation experts, they all said, yeah, 5 to 10 years for the technology. That totally makes sense. But you're crazy if you think the FAA is going to let this happen that quickly, just because the FAA's main priority is safety, and it doesn't move that quickly. This is also an entirely new kind of aircraft that's never been used commercially before. And so there isn't even a category of airplane within which you can certify it yet. They'd have to build a new category. Then they'd have to figure out, okay, how does air traffic control work? How do these things communicate with one another? What kind of pilot training do we need? There are just so many questions. That's the part that's going to take the longest here.
You know, Sanjeev, are there other ways to use these things?
Yeah, sure. I think that there are a number of applications. One for which there is probably a good commercial case in the short term has to do with transport. There are many people who are thinking about how to transport something like between 50 and 100 pounds or maybe a little bit more from one place to another. It could be something critical. And right now, the way to transport these things is that you get them to an airport, the closest airport, then you actually have to drive from there. And if it was critical, even possibly something that was somewhat sporadic, you could imagine using the same kind of a vehicle to do delivery of some sort. Okay, so not quite the Amazon idea of delivering your cleats or whatever else you want to your doorstep using a small drone, but a slightly different concept of a scale of if it could carry two or three passengers, it can then do the transport. There's another idea of doing search and rescue.
Oh, that's interesting.
There's somebody who's injured or there's a disaster of some sort. We might be able to get such vehicles out and then take people out of these kinds of areas in which they need to be evacuated. So there are other use cases. Obviously, this kind of personal transport thing is very compelling if we could bring all of the elements together.
Alex, I'm leaving this conversation sort of beginning to wonder whether we can accomplish all this stuff in the next decade to make these cars practical and people actually using them. Am I right in concluding that?
I think 10 years is optimistic. 10 years, to be clear, is Uber's number. But I think that, you know, if the FAA really got on board or if various regulators said, yes, we really want this to happen, let's make this happen, then 10 years doesn't sound that crazy. 15, 20 is probably a bit more likely for having something that really works and is well established. But, you know, 10 years is aggressive, but not totally nuts.
That's Alex Davies. He's transportation editor for Wired. His coverage of the future of mobility is available on wired.com. He joins us this morning by Skype. Alex, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sanjeev Singh is CEO and co-founder of Near Earth Autonomy and a faculty member at Carnegie Mellon's Robotic Institute. Sanjeev, thanks very much to you as well.
My pleasure.
That conversation originally aired in November. Let's take a break. When we return, hear how big and open data can help improve cities. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. Tomorrow, our conversations that look at two major concerns for parents, getting your children to sleep, and what it could mean when your child gets a headache. As more cities get access to gigabit internet speeds, they're grappling with what to do with it. In May, hundreds of civic leaders, techies, and innovators from all over came to Kansas City for the Gigabit City Summit, where they learned how to use super-fast internet in their cities. We'll start with the idea of open data, that some data should be freely available for everyone to use.
Joining me now, Brett Goldstein was the Chief Data and Information Officer for the City of Chicago. Now he's a Senior Fellow in Urban Science at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. He joins us from WBEZ Studios in Chicago. And Brett, nice to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Eric Roach is with me here in the studio. He's the Chief Data Officer and Performance Management Analyst for the City of Kansas City, Missouri. Eric, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
You know, Brett, we're living in a time when gigabit fiber and smart city sensors provide a lot more data for a city than ever before. Can you put into perspective for me just how much and what kind of information we're talking about here?
Yeah, we're talking about enormous data. So 10 years ago, we lived in a world where everything was paper, you had file cabinets, things were hard to get. At this point, we have systems all over the place that has data from business licenses to crimes to permits, you name it. The key is we have all this data, it's moving over these wonderful architectures, but how do we actually turn this data into information and make it useful to our cities?
Where do we even begin to make sense of all this stuff, much less turn it into something that we can take action on?
Yeah, well, we start with basic steps, and we're seeing cities at different points in the life cycle. So Chicago in 2011, we started to go down this path of open data, and at this point, we have a really advanced program. What I suggest to new cities in the space is do basic things. Release data sets that people care about. Let it get out to the public. Let hackathons happen. Have small impact. And then you start to move to more sophisticated programs.
Eric, what's your perspective on this?
We're really interested in putting data out there that people can use either in Excel or building maps off of or building apps off of it even. And how can they look at our data and advocate for programs that they care about? And so that we're all on the same page, though, because we're all looking at the same data set. So it removes policy a little bit from the I feel and into the more, okay, we understand that this is the issue. This neighborhood has more trees that need to be trimmed than this neighborhood. So maybe that's how we need to allocate resources.
So this is true democracy, Eric, sort of at work here. You're relying on the general public to sort of weigh in here and show you things that maybe you guys haven't thought about.
Absolutely. So our favorite data set is the 3-in-1 data set.
And a 3-in-1?
A 3-1-1 data set.
3-1-1.
So when people pick up the phone in KCMO, they call 3-1-1, they get a number or they get someone at the city who kind of asks them, hey, how can I help you today? We handle all issues from I had like a tree trimmed in my yard to there's a street lamp out or there's a pothole in front of my driveway. All those calls come in and we log them and we then look at that to really see how neighborhoods are changing over time.
I'm wondering, why is it so important for this data to stay open? Why be transparent with all this information?
Something I've learned, I grew up in the startup world, and we're seeing folks at Google, Facebook, LinkedIn using data to do really amazing things. What I would argue is, let's use our data to do amazing things. By making it open, we're able to engage folks to look at problems in a new way. And also, government has a history of we think within our departments, when in fact the problems we have are interdisciplinary. Put it out there, bring it together, apply real data science, and we're able to do things that we never thought we could do before.
How often do you have people in Chicago who come to you and say, you know, I've been crunching these numbers and I came up with this. Have you thought about it?
So it actually happens more often than you might think.
Huh.
When I started as a chief data officer, I started going out to hack nights and meetup nights, and people were shocked. Here's a guy who works in City Hall, and he's going out to coding events, and he knows how to code himself. That encouraged people to look at data, and we found that by people taking this massive amount of data and looking at it with fresh eyes, they would see problems in new ways. And instead of it being an us versus them, it was a we're working together. We're going to use our smart engineering and smart mathematics to really change our city in a better way.
Brett, can you give me an example of that?
Well, a project that we've been really excited about at the University of Chicago has been looking at the relationship between weather and crime. Traditional public safety, they'd say when it's hot, there's more crime out there.
Right.
But we found it was more nuanced than that, that certain blocks and tracks would have violence a certain way based on the environmental conditions, and that changes in temperatures were very meaningful. And this was a wonderful example of taking data like crime, which historically hadn't been open in bulk, weather data, which is enormous and open through NOAA, and then looking at it in a new way and starting to think about tools that can make our communities safer.
And that helped your police department, you're saying?
When we take data science and these advanced principles out of what would traditionally be the Silicon Valley or academia, and we make them available to municipalities, this is how we do business smarter. There's no reason we shouldn't have the same standards we have in the private sector or in Silicon Valley to have a smart business. We should, in fact, have a true smart city that is driven by advanced data analytics.
Eric, how about you in Kansas City here? Have you come across folks who've called you up?
Yeah, certainly. So we've been working exclusively with the Code for America Brigade in showing up weekly, and I think it's a really great way. It changes that interaction between city and government. And I actually went there and I said, we have this new data set up on open data. It's got all of our property violations in it. People's weeds have grown too long, the chipping paint. And so I asked them, we don't have the amount of people or the expertise to look at this, but the people in this room do. Can you help us? And so we started a project, and we've met every week for about 3 or 4 months now, where we dig into that data and we see what can we find. And now we're pulling in census data, and we're trying to relate our code violations to what we can see in census data and help us understand what type of neighborhoods face what type of code violations, and starting to looking at it at a more minute level. And it's really just kind of this opportunity to learn together.
Does that begin to impact how the city dispatches its crews around the city?
So when we get new data and we feel that we can trust it and we move on it, we do change how we allocate resources. So there was a discussion a couple years back where we needed to cut some money from the budget. We were able to say, whatever you do, don't cut tree trimming services. We've heard from citizens on our citizen survey that that's extremely important. And we see in the data that there's more and more requests for tree services coming in through 3-1-1. So don't cut that. And we didn't.
So, Eric, you're saying that these computer whizzes, they'll just do this for kicks, for fun. They're volunteering time on behalf of the city, in a sense.
I think there's a lot of people who want to connect to their city. You used to be able to give back to your country by joining the military, which is amazing, or you could give back by picking up trash on the side of the road. But this is a great way for everyone to kind of leverage their own skill sets and have the maximum effect on their community.
And Brett, you're seeing the same thing in Chicago. People want to help out in this new and different way.
So in Chicago, we have quite a large software engineering community. And they're very excited to work on these problems. But something that we're seeing as cities evolve to be these data-driven entities is a merge between policy and data science. And I think as we look at the folks who work in government in the future, we're going to see a blending of these skills. The old days of making policy in a more qualitative way have ended, because now you have these decision support mechanisms, which can be true empirical. And really, I would call it hyper-focused. We don't create policies for cities as a whole, but we start thinking about small neighborhoods and what is the right treatment, what is the right solution, so we can really work on getting it right from the beginning.
That's interesting. What kind of challenges has Kansas City faced, I'm thinking, in organizing all this data, and second, in actually making it something that's useful?
I think the first thing is really we have a ton of data, and we're always discovering like, oh, cool, this one person who's been here 30 years has kept a spreadsheet on population by neighborhood for 30 years or something. This is amazing. How do we put it out there? So for us, it's always kind of a constant discovery process. The second thing we're really focused on, though, is it's not just enough to put it out there on open data so people can download it. You have to show how we're using it, give demos of how it can be used, and tell the data's story as you see it. And then people can begin to engage because they've seen how other people have used it. And they said, well, I can use it to do something similar, but for my own purpose.
And again, you're not having trouble finding people out there who are willing to help out.
No, the community is full of them. Kansas City is so involved with this.
Yeah. Brett, how does privacy factor into all this? I mean, I can imagine there are people out there listening to this right now, and they're thinking, I'm all for more informed policy, but this sounds a little bit like Big Brother hanging around.
Privacy is key to this. It is critical that you tell your constituents and your residents what you are doing, and that's one of the beauties of open data. But at the same time, we need to couple being smart with not being afraid. As we release more and more data, we do need to think about things like re-identification of parties and things like that. But there is a body of computer science knowledge that work there. It's an ongoing dialogue, active via Twitter, meetups. Talk about what you're doing. Talk about people's fears, but don't let fear stymie us making our city smarter.
You know, Eric, in Kansas City, where is this open data?
So they can go to data.kcmo.org, and it's all up there, and just start searching for what you're interested in. data.kcmo.org.
Okay, well, that's all this is so interesting. I want to thank Brett Goldstein, Chief Data and Information Officer for the City of Chicago, Eric Roach, Chief Data Officer and Performance Management Analyst for the City of Kansas City, Missouri. Gentlemen, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That conversation aired first in May. We just heard how data collection can make for better policymaking. Now let's hear how that kind of information can make cities more efficient.
Joining us now is Jim Epp. He's the manager of water operations for the Kansas City Board of Public Utilities. He's been with BPU for 27 years.
Good morning.
Fred Ellermeyer is the vice president and chief operating officer of Black & Veatch's Smart Integrated Infrastructure Team. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning, Jim.
Well, Jim, you've been in this industry for nearly three decades. How quickly are things changing now that we're able to exchange information almost instantaneously?
Well, it's changing very quickly. The technology for reading meters and doing leak detection in water system is expanding rapidly. And
tell me about leak detection. How does internet and high tech help you with that?
Well, we implemented an automated meter reading system, an automated metering intelligence system, and we read our meters remotely. We collect.
So people don't come around and knock on your doors anymore like they used to back in the day.
That's correct. We get the data every hour. It reads on 15-minute intervals. And then we take that data, and once a day we run a report. And if your meter usage crosses a certain threshold, and this is for residential customers, or never goes to zero, like overnight, it spits out a report. And we actually call the customer and say, hey, we think you have something going on in your house. And a lot of times it's a toilet that hasn't shut off. It's still running.
Yeah.
I think the first call we ever made, the lady was out of town. And we told her there's something going on in your house. And she says, well, how could that be? I'm not even home.
Huh.
And then she says, oh, my gosh. I think I left the water hose running in the backyard.
Oh, no kidding.
So sure enough, we either went out there or she sent a neighbor over and she left the water on. I think it's fantastic that we can call the customer and the customer's like, wow, the water utility called me and said I had a leak. They're helping me save money. And it's just great for customer service.
Water's a city-owned utility. So is energy. How is the city making these utilities even more efficient for its citizens?
At the utility itself, we're trying to use technology to be more efficient. The way I see it is anytime a municipality and the utility can work together, it's a very strong team presence when you're trying to attract new development to your community. I think the point I hit on during the conference was it's very attractive for a city to own their utility, and that's what occurs in Kansas City, Kansas.
Well, Fred, as Kansas City begins to deploy smart sensors, you know, traditional business models are going to have to adapt to this new age of information and technology. How can you bring utilities into this new era?
You know, it really is about the data. That's what you've hit on in this conversation. And the devices are very intelligent. There's new innovation going on across all of the different city and municipal and utility aspects, whether that's a smart streetlight, connected kiosk, the applications being applied to the leak detection. But the utilities have some of the biggest opportunities from an efficiency standpoint, using their equipment better, more efficiently, more productively, but even in the avoidance of putting in new equipment. If you can run it more efficiently, you can write out the existing systems, and using technology allows you to do that.
How fast is this transformation happening from your vantage point at Black & Veatch?
We see it exploding across the scene. And again, it is that drive towards the use of data. The sensor capabilities, there's a convergence of technologies. The edge processing, the ability to store information, the cloud computing, all of that is converging in this time and allowing utilities and cities to take these steps. So it is happening very quickly. Kansas City is a good example. It's one of the places in the world today where Mayor James is driving as a visionary leader to bring all these things together. And we're going to see that happening more and more across our landscape.
From your vantage point, again, is Kansas City ahead of the curve or in the middle of the curve? Where are we?
That's a question we get a lot. Kansas City really is ahead of the curve. To have a smart utility is great. To have a smart business is wonderful. To have a university that's driving the conversation is fantastic. But it takes that municipal city leader that's bringing all of those things together to truly create a smart city. And Kansas City is leading the way.
In other words, a leader who's saying we're not only going to have smart technology, but we're going to utilize that technology to gain efficiencies across the board.
You've got it.
What is the Black & Veatch Smart Integrated Infrastructure Team? What is that, Fred?
Well, as a 100-year-old company, Black & Veatch focuses on utility from telecommunications, power, all of the grid conversation, water and wastewater. But we saw this convergence of new technologies coming in, whether that's the connected kiosks, the electric vehicle charging infrastructure, and we knew that the drive there was, yes, deployment of new technologies, but that drive to use data better and better. And that's what the Smart Integrated Infrastructure Team is doing, is bringing these new technologies, these new connected devices, folded across a telecommunications network, and then helping beneficially use the data through our Asset 360 analytics platform.
All this new technology has to be costly for a city to adapt. You work with the Kansas City Board of Public Utilities. To what extent is the utility, is the city keeping up with all this change? Is it able to afford it?
It is costly. What we try to do, and I'm kind of speaking for the water side because that's my side of the business, we try to take baby steps. We try to look at a technology, do a pilot, try a certain area to deploy meter reading, collection of data, district metering, potentially then leak detection, and just see how cost-effective it is and see if it works. And then see if it tells us what we want, do a return on investment on it, say, okay, now I think we can go forward with this to the next step. You really got to do your homework, look at it carefully, not just try to jump in and bite off more you can chew.
Because some technology, sort of the promise of it may exceed the practical application?
That is correct.
And you're constantly trying to evaluate that?
Yes, constantly trying to evaluate it.
So when you guys went to this automatic meter reading technology and there's no longer people knocking on your door saying meter reader kind of thing, what kind of cost came with installing a system like that? That couldn't have been cheap.
I think we went into it with about a 3 to 5 year return on investment. Yes, you have to implement the infrastructure for the telecommunications. You have to implement the meters and the modules to communicate back to the gatekeepers, then bring it all into a meter data management system and customer service billing system. So It's an extensive effort, but the savings on labor and truck rolls, for instance, on the light side, they can turn on and turn off meters without rolling the truck. They can do it remotely.
Wow. Wow.
So that technology is not quite there on the water side, but it is on the electric. Anytime you don't have to roll a truck, that's going to save $50 to $75. It's right there. So you got to look at it on how it's going to add to your bottom line and improve your customer service.
You know, I'm wondering, Fred, are there technologies out there that you look at and you think, why aren't more cities doing this or doing that? Here's big cost savings if you just try this.
It's great to be able to work with people like Jim and the Board of Public Utilities. They see the opportunities in technology. And what's really amazing, you talk about the cost structures, you're going to see this bringing in new revenue streams even.
Revenue in what way?
Connected kiosk is a great example. You have what we're calling street furniture sitting on the sidewalks of our cities that now bring in revenue streams to the city through advertising that provide a connected capability for the citizenry. And you talk
because
about...
Because the kiosks provide information at the same time there's advertising that goes along with it.
That's correct. Street lighting is another great example. The street light now is really just a hub of technology. It can be detecting weather. It can be a gunshot detection capability.
How does a street light do that?
all of the new smart street lighting systems coming out from people like Philips and GE, and there's a host of different technologies. You can have video as a sensor that's providing protection for the citizenry. It can be providing things like smart parking. But you also have the pole structure. You can use those poles for distributed antenna systems. You can rent out space on the pole. So there's these opportunities now to use city infrastructure that used to be a cost, and now it becomes an ability or an opportunity to bring in a revenue stream.
You know, if we're having this conversation in 5 or 10 years, what will the key concerns of energy and water in the smart city of the future be at that time? Jim, any sense?
Next 5 to 10 years, the business model on the electric utility is really changing. We're in a business where we have to promote to our customers to use less power. If you're JCPenney and you tell your customers to buy less clothes, how do you work that business model?
Mm-hmm.
On that side, you know, we're looking at wind power, solar, gas. It's good to have a balanced portfolio going forward. 10 years from now, it'll be more renewables, less coal, and a nice portfolio mix. On the water side, I really see leak detection technology and pipe infrastructure technology, investigation, non-destructive testing, really, really taking off to where you can really go into your system, because all the pipes are underground. You can't mm-hmm. see them. So you need technology to determine, well, where's my greatest risk of failure in a pipe? And where do I need to spend the money before that catastrophic failure happens?
Yeah.
So that technology is starting to explode, and we're taking a very close look at it because we have 50 to 80-year-old mains. We need to replace them, but you can only replace them so fast. You have to do it where you're getting your best bang of the buck.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Jim Epp again, Manager of Water Operations for the Kansas City Board of Public Utilities, Fred Ellermeyer, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer from over at Black & Veatch. Gentlemen, thank you very much for a good conversation. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Steve.
You bet.
Jim Epp and Fred Ellermeyer joined us in May of 2016. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcasts at kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. On tomorrow's program, getting your children to sleep and how to deal with headaches in kids. Today's segments were originally produced with help from Lisa Rodriguez, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Caperton Morton. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Danny Alexander, in for Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.